You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Our last piece today is from Oscar Perez, who is just constantly with us on the news team, which I very much appreciate. He spoke to Samuel Miller McDonald, a journalist, writer and student currently based in the UK for his studies at Oxford, and they spoke for over an hour. But their discussion around COVID-19 can be understood as a discussion on a need for systems change. And you would have heard a few of these segments earlier where they touched on the climate and liberties. Today, though, we're hearing about national emergencies. So when COVID-19 arrived on the shores of the UK, Miller McDonald wrote an op-ed for The Guardian detailing common patterns that emerge from national emergencies and how these could possibly occur again with COVID-19. Oscar started by asking Miller McDonald to explain those patterns and whether they were likely to emerge if they hadn't already with COVID-19.
The piece starts out just looking at September 11th terrorist attacks in the U.S. and the Great Recession in the U.S., the collapse of the housing market, and made the case that both of those emergencies elicited a similar response from the government. And that response was basically to do two things. One, to consolidate power. Two, to consolidate wealth. And the former happened in the case of 9/11, when the Bush administration started passing all of these laws like the Patriot Act with, you know, of course, complete consent from Congress, which really kind of pushed the limits of what the Constitution guarantees and even pushes past that, I think some would argue, and set some legal precedents that have been compounded, have been since in 2012, Obama passed an expansion to one of those, the NDAA, which went very far in sort of consolidating that executive power and the ability to, for instance, indefinitely detain citizens. And the second happened, the concentration of wealth happened in the first case in 9/11 with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, which involved moving trillions of public dollars into, you know, defense contractors and private contractors who played a huge role in the operations of those invasions and occupations. In the case of the housing market collapse, that wealth concentration happened with the bailout, with the Wall Street bailout, which is, you know, essentially what it was. It was this massive injection of, again, you know, trillions of dollars, moving that from the public treasury into these private companies and private bank accounts. And what the piece was about was basically that this emergency opens the door for those kinds of abuses to happen again. And there have been a couple of indications that the Trump administration will follow that pattern. But, you know, I think at this point, it's still kind of rapidly changing. And, you know, there's this stimulus that is being debated. And I think there's a way to address these kinds of national emergencies that don't involve doing those two things. You know, we don't have to try to consolidate power in the executive or consolidate wealth in private corporations and private bank accounts. And, you know, those things don't solve the problem, right? It's not like those are just unfortunate consequences of solutions. Those don't do anything to actually solve the problem. It's just an opportunity for people who want more power and money to, you know, get more of those things. The point of the Guardian piece that I was trying to get through was that there are a lot of times when you can be, when that doesn't have to be the choice, you know, that's a sort of false choice between safety, security, and civil liberties. And that I think there are a lot of actions that governments can be taking that can be both protecting people from this virus and also increasing civil liberties. So, for instance, the first I kind of included this list of responses that I think can do that. And the first one, for instance, was the subsistence level universal basic income. And I think it's a good illustration of this principle of being able to both protect people and expand civil liberties. And so that does that, I think, by one, providing the means to basically self-isolate more than many people have the means to do right now, either, you know, preventing people from having to go out to work or from having to make, you know, multiple trips to the supermarket. If there's this sort of guaranteed source of income that people can plan for and shape their lives around, it's these kinds of, you know, self-isolation lockdown measures are a lot more feasible to do without force, you know, without enforcing with fines. And I think the second way is by ensuring that there's continued access to healthcare that at least in the States, and I know this isn't as much a problem in the UK where there's an NHS and I think I don't know New Zealand's health system as well, but I'm sure it's not as insane as the US, where you know people are foregoing care because they can't afford it, and having some kind of guaranteed income stream, I think, is a way to you know protect people and just give them the freedom to have money and be able to purchase what they need and not worry about going bankrupt because they got sick.
With two internationally received but US-specific examples in 9/11 and the 2008 housing market crash, Miller McDonald reiterated that although rooted in America, these patterns can and have emerged elsewhere, each attuned and different depending on the locality.
Absolutely dependent on circumstance and locality and you know culture and the political system there. I think these patterns will express themselves in very different ways depending on where they're occurring. And I think some of the principles in that piece can be broadly applicable. You know, I don't think they need to be specific to a US context. I think you can be wherever these kinds of lockdowns are taking place or wherever civil liberties are being put on the scale. I think you can be trying to approach these issues from a standpoint of maximizing both protection and civil liberties. And I think it's even within the US, it's more complicated. You know, you have, I think, a lot of state governments in the US that are very earnestly trying to do this, trying to save people's lives and protect civil liberties. And I think there's less of an attempt to follow this pattern of concentrating wealth, concentrating power, even often in opposition to the federal government. And we've, you know, just seen that recently with states, you know, saying they're going to band together to access PPE because the federal government is withholding it. And I think that conflict, even within countries, can really impact this. And I think it comes down to the more accountable the level of government we're dealing with, the more accountable they are to the people they're trying to protect, I think the easier it is to protect civil liberties as well. And the less accountable, the more likely they're going to fall into this pattern of just, you know, not being concerned with their citizens, but being more concerned with maintaining this, you know, a consolidated executive and consolidated wealth.
They continued by discussing the opportunity that national emergencies and crises present us with in breaking these patterns and taking new paths into the future.
What I think this is illustrating is that, like you say, a lot of these practices and institutions and things that we take for granted are really arbitrary. And it's breaking up the sort of hold that they have on our lives. And it, I think, you know, the one positive to that is it makes it easier to imagine alternatives and imagine pathways to actually bringing those alternatives into the world. And I think, you know, on my most optimistic days, I think climate emergencies can do something similar. I think they offer this opportunity for breaking apart these really old, you know, lingering power structures that have been impossible to break open. And of course, the inverse to that is that the new power structures that replace them could be a lot worse. And I think the way in which we respond to this crisis, but also other, you know, climate ecological emergencies going into the future, is really going to determine those kinds of power structures that get baked in to the 21st century and what becomes possible and how we respond to future crises. You know, I think it's a real kind of feedback situation where responding to this and others like it with authoritarianism will just breed more authoritarianism and make it all the harder to imagine these better, you know, more fair, more free ways of ordering society into the future.
Last week, Oscar Perez was able to talk to Samuel Miller McDonald, a journalist, writer, and student currently based in the UK for his studies at Oxford. Though talking for over an hour, their discussion around COVID-19 can be understood as a discussion on systems. In the initial weeks of mass shutdowns, false claims of environmental regeneration circulated the media and internet alike. Apparently in Italy, marine life returned to the Venetian canals that have long been polluted by nitrous dioxide, but where the water is now clearer than it has been in 60 years. The lower air pollution, according to one study in China caused by COVID-19, also may save up to 77,000 lives. To this, there was a reactionary groundswell parroting the Matrix agent Smith in identifying us, humans, as the virus that has created Papatūānuku's ills. One tweet from at Thomas Scholes offering Agent Smith's line verbatim has over 297,000 likes at the time of writing. Many in political circles, including Oscar himself, initially pointed at posts promoting COVID-19 as a solution for environmental recovery, be it true or not, as examples of eco-fascism. Miller McDonald unpacks this discourse a little more and touches on the dangers of arbitrarily and incorrectly, labelling political phenomena as such. Referencing a recent editorial Miller McDonald wrote for Current Affairs magazine.
I started writing that piece in January before all of this discourse around, like, humans are the virus, that's eco-fascism, was coming up. So that I kind of had to slip a little mention of that into the piece later as it was about to be published. I think a lot of the, like, humans are a virus, those kinds of messages, I think, are misanthropic. You know, they're deeply cynical and pessimistic. Unless they're advocating for authoritarianism or ethno-nationalism, they're not eco-fascism by any reasonable definition of the term. So I, you know, just to clarify that, I think it's important to not just call everything eco-fascism that we think is ugly. But I think the bigger danger is that we let much more powerful institutions that are substantively bringing eco-fascist values into the world, so ethno-nationalist values, ideas of, you know, eliminating surplus populations, ideas of imposing authoritarian responses to emergencies. I think these are all, you know, reasonably under this umbrella of eco-fascism, but they're also under the umbrella of the kind of economic liberalism or settler colonialism that has just been at the heart of, you know, liberal governments for the last 300, 400 years. So in the middle of it, there's a little game in which I have 25 quotes from these heroes, famous, legendary heroes of Western civilization, Charles Darwin, Thomas Jefferson, Winston Churchill, whatever, or whether they're from the manifestos of eco-fascist shooters. And I didn't think I'd be able to find so many, and I didn't think they'd be so racist. But I found just a ton of quotes from these luminaries that we still hold up as heroes and as the greatest intellectual minds of Western civilization. And they're advocating for this kind of social Darwinism. You know, they're advocating for eliminating indigenous people and eliminating populations that are standing in the way of the efficiency of the liberal market. And I think what the danger is in painting eco-fascism as this sort of like fringe online incel, you know, whatever phenomenon, is that it can section off those values into this delinquent, scary monster instead of recognizing that those are the values that are held by, you know, the people who run many of the world's biggest governments right now. And I think there's a risk that those governments will be able to sort of keep the ugly, explicit kinds of messages in the, you know, the eco-fascist manifesto at arm's length. And this did happen in the wake of the Christchurch shooting. Kellyanne Conway, the advisor to Trump, went on television and called him he's an eco-naturalist, he's an eco-terrorist, he's crazy, whatever, don't worry about him, when he was inspired by Trump, by Trump's ethno-nationalism. So I think it's not to in any way diminish the real danger of these ideas. It's to the opposite of that, say they're much more prevalent than I think we recognize when we just say it's some eco-fascist on Twitter who's talking about how humans are a virus.
With these values perhaps still prevalent or even protected in many international governments and political structures, Oscar asks Samuel how this has or will shape our continued response to COVID-19 and other crisis-like issues.
I think this issue is really revealing a lot of these ingrained injustices and inequalities and assumptions. And I think it's really illustrating some of the real cruelty of this economic liberal approach to issues, you know, and that can maybe best be illustrated in the UK and the US, where the attitude, at least at the beginning, was we need to not save people's lives because it could harm the economy. We need to not have a lockdown, or we need to not self-isolate for the sake of the stock market. I think that's just the perfect distillation of this idea that the thing that matters most is the health of the markets. I think one positive is that I think people have generally looked at that response and realized how cruel it really is. And I think if, you know, part of what we need to be doing right now is saying that cruelty is not new. Trump coming along and saying, let's sacrifice the elderly for the stock market, that's not a new phenomenon. That's been happening for decades. You know, the austerity in the UK has been happening for decades and has been killing tens of thousands of people for decades. You know, this isn't a new ugly thing. Again, like eco-fascism isn't a new ugly thing. These are policies and results that have been killing people for a very long time. And I think if this can illuminate that in a way that allows us to think about an alternative and figure out some better way to be ordering our economies and societies, then that will be great. Again, I think it's still kind of a toss-up which way it goes. Do these aspiring authoritarians take this emergency and really run with it and use it as an opportunity, as Orban has just done, to seize unlimited or indefinite power? Or do we use this as an opportunity to remove aspiring authoritarians from power and completely form those power structures? And at this point, I don't know. It seems like it could go either way. And I don't see a lot of indication at the moment that it's going to go the good way. It seems like most things are kind of stacked against the positive response to this. But, you know, you gotta keep a little bit of faith that remains possible.
Last week, Oscar Perez was able to talk to Samuel Miller MacDonald, a journalist, writer, and student currently based in the UK for his studies at Oxford. Though talking for over an hour, their discussion around COVID-19 can be understood as a discussion on a need for systems change. Miller MacDonald's studies are focused in climate and energy politics, so a large section of their discussion was around conceptualising a response to the climate crisis from how our world has reacted and responded to COVID-19. Oscar started by asking Miller MacDonald for his initial reaction to the global response to COVID-19 and what we need to take from it to start a response to the climate crisis.
I think what's been maybe most frightening about it is just how quickly everything has gone down, how everything has changed in such a short amount of time, and anticipating some of the ripple effects of that. I think there are a lot of impacts of this that we're not going to see for a while and don't know how to anticipate. And I think the lack of coordination in both anticipating this and trying to anticipate the forthcoming impacts of it is frightening for me. And it's kind of maybe the closest to failing a test for future climate or environmental disasters that are almost certainly going to come. And it seems like this response shows that we're very far behind where we need to be in dealing with these kinds of impacts. You know, it seems like there's a real fragility to the supply chains that provide everything that we need to survive. And there's a fragility to the governments and to the order of things. And yeah, I guess it's something that worries me, but it does show that you can have global coordination happen. You can have it happen fast. You know, there has been, even though the anticipation was poor, and even though you had all of these sort of national governments looking out for their own interests, I think there has at least been some response to this that has happened fairly quickly. And I think, you know, the climate emergencies that are coming are all going to happen quickly as well. You know, the climate change as a whole, as a phenomenon, is a kind of slow, long-term, you know, centuries-long process, but all of the constituent emergencies within it are very fast. You know, they hit with a very fast intensity, whether it's hurricanes or wildfires or refugee crises or whatever. I don't know. I say that this is a kind of failed test, but I think there are also tests within this that are indicating that we can move very quickly. We can move infrastructure. We can move resources when we need to. Things can be deployed very quickly. And of course, we already knew that. We've seen, you know, war mobilizations in the past, and we know that's possible. I think maybe one of the lessons of this crisis is, how do we replicate this urgency with a problem like ecological collapse or climate change that always feels either geographically distant, something that's happening somewhere else, or temporally different, distant, something that's happening in the future or is happening to, you know, generations away from now. And I think that's something that we can certainly learn from. But is also a challenge of the climate crisis is being able to summon that kind of urgency that this has been able to create.
Oscar continued by asking what it is that has eventually unified coordination around COVID-19 and how we can replicate this X factor in mobilizing for the climate crisis.
There's something very visceral about a disease, right? It's something that you just feel very instinctively is bad. It's under your skin, literally. And that's something that I think is easier to feel urgency about. You know, it's easier to take, you know, drastic measures to prevent or address. I think it's also more uniform. You know, it's one thing. It causes the same symptoms in people no matter what country they're in. Clearly one phenomenon. Whereas I think something like climate change or ecological collapse, it's many different kinds of phenomena. It's things that look very different from one another that are often very locally specific. I think it's harder to conceptualize all of these as one phenomenon that impacts everybody. You know, I think there's been a real sense with COVID-19 that there's no escape. You know, all trapped here with this illness, and there's no place you can go to escape it. I don't think that's true of climate. I think a lot of people believe that they can escape it. You know, they can go to their bunker, or they can go to an island, or they can get out of the tornado alley, or get out of the, you know, wildfire zone or whatever. They can always escape one of these disasters. And I think there's a lot of, you know, communications work and psychological work to try to really reinforce this idea that climate and ecological collapse are really, it's one phenomenon. There's no escape from it. You know, it's the same. We're all trapped in here, and this is impacting all of us, and it's going to impact all of us in different ways. But it's the same thing. And if we don't meet that phenomenon with the urgency and intensity that we're meeting a virus, then we're going to suffer from that. And I think part of that work of making this seem like one issue is part of it, at least, revealing the source of it. And the source of it is this particular kind of economy based on fossil fuels. And, you know, you can't fight climate change, but you can fight fossil fuel companies, and you can fight the governments that prop them up. And part of something that's happening in the U.S. right now is Trump is trying to bail out the oil industry, and the Keystone Pipeline Company is trying to get the pipeline built. The construction had been shut down for years since Obama's administration, but they're trying to get that started back up in the chaos of all of this. So I think part of this project is saying climate change is one thing. It's one phenomenon. It's like this virus. It happens everywhere. It affects everybody on every continent all the time. But I think instead of looking at it as this sort of just naturalistic force, saying instead, no, there are individuals, and there are companies, and there are governments that are making this happen. And that's the root of this. And that's what binds all of this together. And we're only going to solve it when we go after them. I think it's something that has to happen at every level. You have to have the grassroots in place. You know, you have to have these big coalitions of people who are willing to go out in the streets, go out and organize their works, their workplaces. You have to have it also in the White House, in the Congress, in the heads of state that are currently, you know, colluding to maintain this fossil fuel economy. And I think it doesn't happen unless you have all of those levels accounted for, basically. And it's hard, and it's a rare thing when you have those aligned, when you have very powerful political coalition and a very strong, large grassroots movement that are aligned and are able to work together to do something like this. But, you know, it is the biggest, we're talking about the biggest engineering feat, the biggest administrative feat, changing the entire global system of energy production, distribution, of construction, of transportation, all of our supply chains. You know, these are all things that are very deeply dependent on fossil fuels, and they have to not be very rapidly, you know, in a span of years. And that's just something that you can't do it with just the right candidates or just the right prime minister or just the right movement leader. You know, that doesn't, there's not one idea or one platform or one policy, not even just the Green New Deal, that's going to be able to achieve this kind of a thing. It's such a big monumental thing that I think there's not an easy answer to the what do we do next, or what do you do as an individual, or what do you do collectively. It's something that needs to be happening in every workplace and every institution and in global finance and in governments and in giant corporations, you know, and within the fossil fuel industry itself. You know, you have to have something within that that's helping to dismantle it from inside. And I think that's having all of these things operating together is kind of the only thing that's going to get us closer to that goal. I think, at least, that's how I'm looking at this. I think there's an idea that if we just get solar panels down to the right market price, then that will solve everything. You know, that'll just automatically decarbonize everything. And I think that's been clear that that's not the case, that a lot of the new renewable energy production has just augmented, you know, the existing fossil fuel base. It's just added demand. It hasn't really done a whole lot to be reducing emissions. But then you also have to have that, you know, you have to have these replacements, these inexpensive and accessible replacements ready to deploy and to somehow manufacture without fossil fuels and transport without fossil fuels. And I think the answer to this is yes, everything. Yes. Just do it. Do whatever you can all the time, and don't stop, and don't get demoralized, and don't quit, and just keep working on it.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.